From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
And I remember going around the first day of set, introducing myself to everybody, and, oh, and your name is Ryan? Great. And what do you do? I'm the gaffer. Oh, cool. What's a gaffer?
Director Lynn Shelton was a stage actress and photographer before she decided to make movies. With well-regarded indies Hump Day and Your Sister's Sister under her belt, she tells us she's ready to move more mainstream with Laggies, starring Keira Knightley. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, times are changing. HBO is going over the top, and CBS has already launched its own streaming service. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Kim.
Well, a lot of news to talk about today. This past week, first of all, HBO came out as part of a giant presentation that Time Warner did to explain its greatness to Wall Street. I will just pause and say that Time Warner had been under pressure because, as we have previously discussed, Fox, Rupert Murdoch bid for the company a lot of money. They rejected that offer. And now Jeff Bukas, the head of Time Warner, is trying to show the world that he's got a plan and the plan is going to be good and you shouldn't be sad that the sale didn't happen and you didn't get to pocket some profit from that. So as part of that, out comes HBO. Big announcement.
Yeah, actually, HBO announced an over-the-top service, which we've been waiting for a while, and a lot of fans of HBO who don't subscribe to cable have been waiting for as well, which is a service that for an undisclosed sum every month...
You'll get undisclosed
content. You'll get an undisclosed service. We still don't know a lot about this HBO over-the-top service. We don't even know what it's going to be called, although it sounds like it'll probably be similar to HBO Go, which is the service they already have for pre-existing subscribers, both a stream of the channel and also library content and some streaming VOD as well. So for folks who've been looking to buy HBO unbundled from cable, they were rejoicing.
Right. I'm not rejoicing quite yet, but I like the trend because I'm one of those people who gets so many channels that I don't watch and I pay a lot of money. And I see the opportunity now to at least either drop the cable, shave the cable, which I think a lot of people are doing, shave the number of channels that I'm getting, or just threaten to and try to get a better deal.
Yeah, we're going that direction now. The big question, though, is as more of these channels start announcing their own OTT service, at some point, are we going to be spending $8-$10 a month for each channel? And how different, ultimately, are all of our bills going to compare to that old cable bill, that $100 bill that you were paying? Well, now you're going to be paying $10 here, $12 there, $15 here. And
probably a lot for these big sporting events. That could put a lot of pressure on if you want to stream those. I could see them getting more expensive as other people bail from the forced feed of ESPN they get through their cable provider.
Yeah, so ultimately, have you really cut your cord? Well, no, you just bought 12 more cords.
12 more cheaper cords
cheaper
that
cords.
Could aggregate into an expensive cord. However, this is a big business for HBO, potentially. There are 70 million homes in the U.S. that have cable or satellite service without HBO, and 10 million more that have high-speed internet but no pay TV service at all. So that's a lot of potential customers.
This was inevitable. If you're HBO, if you're Richard Plepler, the head of HBO, you're looking at that, and they're already such a massively profitable company. Just imagine once that 70 million is also paying $20 a pop, $15 a pop for this new HBO service, that just makes HBO even more profitable and puts them even further ahead of their big rivals at Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix kind of pushed the button that started this whole thing, I think, but they are not nearly as profitable as HBO. Of course, they're starting up and investing and growing, but they do have more subscribers in the U.S., but they're not in the universe of profitability. And meanwhile, on the heels of HBO saying they're going to do this next year, CBS jumped up and said, well, we're doing it right now. They unveiled their own streaming service, which you pay $6 a month for, and you get, with a day delay, current CBS programming and old CBS shows from the library that they own. So it's potentially another way to drop your cable subscription.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's less revolutionary than the HBO model, only because CBS is basically following suit on what Hulu Plus has already been doing with the other networks. CBS famously never got involved with the Hulu conglomerate and now is going it alone with CBS All Access. So as you said, $6 a a month, you'll be able to watch your local CBS affiliate and also watch some old CBS library. That's great. But at some point again, Kim, are you going to be spending $6 here, $8 there, $15 there, when, you know, ultimately cable with that one bundle is starting to look a little more attractive in comparison?
Yeah, I think we don't quite know where it's going, but I would assume that, you know, everybody's going to start getting more and more aggressively competitive and the landscape will change.
Yeah, and by the way, Kim, one of the other interesting things is the so-called MVPDs, which are the multi-video program distributors, you know, both from satellite like DirecTV, but also cable like Time Warner and Suddenlink and companies like that. Some of the smaller ones especially are looking at programming fees and saying, you know what, maybe we just want to be broadband suppliers and not even be in the programming business. So these interests are going to start to align, and we could be marching toward an eventual future where the big cable companies become more big broadband companies, and basically they're selling piecemeal these channels and these OTT services.
Times are changing, especially in TV. And the film side, going back to this Time Warner dog and pony show for Wall Street, Kevin Sugihara, the head of the Warner Brothers studio, announced they're going to cut a lot of jobs, but they claim they're going to radically increase profitability at the same time. And they announced 10 DC Comics movies, including Batman versus Superman, which was already planned, Wonder Woman, which so we're getting the female lead in one of these comic book movies, all the way through 2020. Green Lantern in 2020, 10 of these, and as well as 3 Harry Potter spinoffs based on the J.K. Rowling Fantastic Beasts novella. So it sounded great. They have 3 more Lego movies, and the studio's been hurting. It hasn't had a good roll. The summer was not very good. They had Blended with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore that didn't work, and other movies that just fell short. So they are rolling that out, and, you know, it sounds great, but, you know, there's a lot that lies in execution, especially with DC Comics.
So 10 movies is a lot, but that's just for starters. I mean, this is just the DC output. And then on top of it all, they also discussed a Lego TV show. So these are a lot of franchises that they're really burning at all ends. And, let's hope that some of these are good.
Yeah, they're going up against Marvel with these DC Comics movies. Marvel has quite a substantial head start. That doesn't mean it won't work. I did find some of it very blue sky, as in, you know, when we close the gap on merchandise with Marvel, we will make this much more money. And I felt like, yeah, okay, let's see it happen.
Well, you know, Kim, DC's actually got a little bit more of a head start in TV, and some of those TV properties will be able to fuel more of these film properties as well, where Marvel has been actually struggling so far on the TV space. So it's interesting to see the fortunes of both companies sort of at a crossroads.
Yeah, I know a lot of American audiences are like, enough with the comic book movies already, but you know what? They still go when they like them, and overseas they are still huge.
The geeks have inherited the business.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Lynn Shelton's films typically have been indies featuring just a few youngish, slightly adrift men and women who talk a lot. Their conversations often feel improvised because often they are. With her newest film, Laggies, Shelton took a more structured approach. It's the first movie she's made that she didn't write herself. Still, as in her earlier films, the focus of Laggies is a relationship. In this case, an oddball friendship that forms when Keira Knightley, as an overeducated but underachieving 28-year-old, starts hanging out with a 16-year-old high schooler played by Chloe Grace Moretz. They first meet outside a liquor store.
We all forgot our IDs. Would you buy a 6-pack or something?
Someone did this for me when I was your age. It's like a rite of passage, right?
I had a good feeling about you.
That makes one of us.
When Shelton sat down to talk with us about her career, she explained that making movies originally wasn't part of her plan. Instead, she earned a master's degree in photography. And before that, she'd studied acting in college.
I moved to New York a couple years after I graduated from college to be an actor. And as soon as I was trying to make a living at it, we kind of had a falling out, theater and I. And after a few years of doing a bunch of downtown performance art and really fun, cool stuff that was not making me any money or going in that direction of figuring out how I was going to make a living in the world, I turned my attentions and transferred my addiction over to photography, which had always been a second love of mine. And at the time, it felt so strange. It was such a hairpin turn. I'd made such a commitment and I'd invested so much time and energy into theater that it was like, what am I doing? You know, but I would just went with my gut. It really felt like what I needed to do to start fulfilling my creative, you know, expressiveness. But my marketable skill getting out of school was editing. So I was editing other people's first corporate and commercial stuff, but moved back to Seattle. I'd grown up in Seattle, started editing other people's narrative work. And that was when I realized, I want to direct now. I can write and direct feature films. And I realized, the theater, the photography, it all kind of made sense. Yeah.
Well, why did you fall out of love with theater?
It was a combination of the fact that I'd been really lucky in college where I just had been cast in a lot of shows and a lot of really great shows, like great roles, great plays that had something positive or interesting anyway to say about the world. The first show I got cast in New York was a series of one acts. They were all new one acts. And I thought, great, I want to work with new voices and new, but the theme was the Grand Guignol, which was this period of time when it was, in French theater history where they would like spray the audience with water to make them feel the blood. It was all like horrible, And basically it was just that. So I realized I was in dress rehearsal or tech or something when I realized, I'm in three different plays. I'm getting acid thrown on my face in one, getting raped and killed in one way and another. And, I realized this is just misogynist crap. What am I doing? And I realized I was that quintessential theater slut. Like I didn't even think about, I just like, you want me to be in your play? Great. And I realized it was for me, it had become this sort of exercise in narcissism. It made me question, like, why did you want to be on stage all this time? It actually had really been healthy for me because I'd been extremely shy as I was growing up, but it just had become, it wasn't fulfilling.
That fulfillment came when she started making short experimental documentaries that were not remotely commercial. Then one of her films caught the attention of the film company. That company gave Shelton the funding, the crew, and the equipment to make another film about anything she wanted.
The director of the film company, Greg Lachow, I think he expected me probably to just make an experimental documentary that was feature length, because you could basically could do anything.
It's like a little mini MacArthur.
Exactly. Fellowship. I was commissioned to make whatever I wanted to make as long as it was feature length. That was it. But little did he know, I hadn't really told anybody, but I'd been harboring the secret desire to write and direct a narrative feature. And so, I said, I don't know. I don't have a script. And he said, that's fine. You'll think of something, And then a week or two later, I was like, I have an idea. And I sort of pitched it. And he was like, yeah, sounds great. Start working on the script. And I said, I don't have a crew. He said, we'll take care of everything. They had the crew. They put the crew together. They put the financing together. It was insane. And I remember going around the first day of set, introducing myself to everybody. And your name is Ryan? Oh, great. And what do you do? I'm the gaffer. Oh, cool. What's a gaffer? I mean, I really didn't know. It was like my final, sort of module of film school that had really taken, many years before that, a long, long time. But it was a long, circuitous route. But I learned so much and I had such, it was a totally transformative experience making this feature. I knew at the end of it that I never wanted to make another piece of art by myself again. And all of a sudden I went from this control freak kind of artist that didn't want to give up any, inch to anybody else to becoming an artist where relationship was everything.
The result was the 2006 film, We Go Way Back. After that, Shelton was hooked. She sought out collaborators like Mark Duplass, who, along with his brother Jay, is one of the founders of Mumblecore, the movement known for naturalistic films about slightly off-track youngish people who are clever and copious talkers. Duplass starred in Shelton's 2009 movie Hump Day, about two straight male friends who, on a dare, decide to shoot a gay porn movie starring themselves. Much of the film's dialogue is improvised as the characters played by Duplass and Joshua Leonard work through the ultimate will they or won't they.
So here's where I'm at, okay? I don't want to chicken out on this, right? But I can't help thinking, what exactly about two straight dudes having sex on camera is a great piece of art?
We're doing this because it scares us more than anything else.
Hump Day premiered at Sundance, where it played well and was acquired by Magnolia Pictures. It got only a very limited theatrical release, but still, the film was a financial success for Shelton.
When you have a script that's so simple, and it's basically one key location, you can shoot it in 10 days.
A house and a hotel room, basically.
Exactly. Really contained. And you only have three characters, two mostly, sometimes three. You can have a smaller crew. You can shoot it in less days. You don't have to feed as many people. You don't have to have as much equipment. Like, all of it just scales way down. So we were able to make it.
You got grants for it?
Yeah. And I got grants for it, and I raised the money. Because I had gone to art school and had applied for grants and really was approaching my work as an art piece as opposed to a commercial entity, where I, you know, film really crosses that. You know, it overlaps, right? And some people are just like, it's total commerce.
Right.
Well, it really is kind of both for me, you know, right. Now. But at a certain point, it was like really just art. And I was comfortable, much more comfortable applying for grants than I was putting together a business plan and looking for. And frankly, this was a really risky endeavor creatively. And if we had tried to make it in some sort of system where we were like, yeah, you're going to make your money back with this ridiculous, you know, we wanted to make it for as small an amount and as low risk as possible so that we could really try to not think about how risky this was. And then if it didn't work out, we could just sweep it under the rug and nobody would need to know, you know? So it was really a truly independent film. It was really fun because we had total creative control and I could really make the movie that I wanted to make.
For what
and
kind
I didn't
of a
have to. Like, really, Kim, pennies. I mean, you know, when you look at the grand scope of things, it was, and I didn't have even that amount. I didn't have to make back. I didn't have to pay anybody back. It was all grants or people had written me $1,000 check that was a tax deductible donation because I had fiscal sponsorship through this nonprofit film organization. I mean, it was like totally in the free and clear from the beginning. So any profit for that movie would have been great. And it actually, you know, it did much better than it would seem like if you look at Box Office Mojo because we sold it to all kinds of foreign territories. It kept appearing on, you know, pay television and all kinds of places. And so that film kept me afloat for years.
Really?
I
mean, looking at the premise, I can see why people might not see it as necessarily a film, a theater film.
So. I mean, Magnolia really wanted it, really thought that it would be a crossover hit. But ultimately, what I found out as the years passed by is that a lot of people, especially straight men,
yeah,
were
like,
literally terrified to watch it.
Yeah.
Terrified, which is hysterical to me.
That.
But they really were. You know, I learned a lot.
Yeah. I mean, Mark Duplass has certainly been all over this idea of different platforms. Do you already see yourself as doing that? Or because you've actually gone into the most commercials, uh-huh. conventional studio film with Laggies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm
which
very...
Which we're now getting to finally.
Yeah. As a filmmaker, I'm very old school, as I think plenty of people still are. My attitude is, I want as many people to see my films in the theater as they possibly can. Every film is a better experience that way. I mean, maybe there are a few that are designed to be seen in another way, but when you're in community, in the dark, being drawn into the film, you know, you just, it's really hard to replicate that, especially in community with strangers. You know, people can create a home theater environment that's sort of similar to that, but I still think it's better to be in that theater environment. So I always love that. At the same time, unbelievably grateful when a film of mine, like Your Sister's Sister, just appeared on Netflix streaming a couple weeks ago. So many people, it's like, have reached out to me to say that they loved it and they finally got around to seeing it because it's so much easier for them to access it. And so would I rather not those people be able to see? Of course I'd love for them to see it however they can see it, you know?
Right.
So I'm well aware of the greater accessibility it gives, you know, and reach it gives my films. So I'm kind of two minds about it. But it would be hard for me to just completely give up on the theatrical dream because that really is the best way for my work to be seen, I think.
Coming up after a short break, Lynn Shelton tells us when she started working on her new film, Laggies, she knew one thing for sure. The title of the film would have to change. And yet, it didn't. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Lynn Shelton about her new movie, Laggies, which stars Keira Knightley as Megan, an educated young woman who lacks the ambition to get a real job or even to move out of her childhood home. After Megan regresses to the point of hanging out with high school student Annika, she meets Annika's divorced single father, played by Sam Rockwell.
Talking about the mixer?
Yeah.
Well, These things, women insist on touching your forearm in this very deliberate manner. These touches are meant to communicate Gold Star level skills in listening and connectedness. Do you know about this kind of gesture?
Yeah, you mean this one?
Yes. Do go on.
Do go on.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Dad, you do know you can't lecture her all night, right? She's not a kid.
Oh, really? You stuck your friend into my house. I think you're lacking say-so here.
Laggies is Shelton's first film that she didn't write herself. Andrea Siegel wrote the screenplay. The $15 million budget is the biggest that Shelton has ever worked with, and she says with this film, she planned to reach a more mainstream audience.
You know, definitely not sell out, but just do something that that was a little bit of a broader scope, bigger canvas, possibly more accessible to a broader audience. And I wasn't looking for a script. You know, it really came to me. It fell into my lap. And I've been reading scripts that my reps send me. They send me really good scripts, but I so rarely feel a personal enough pull towards them that it's like there's this voice saying, oh, you have to direct this or you should direct this. And it was love at first sight when I read this particular script. On paper, it looked like just the concept itself looked like, well, that seems like a movie I would have come up with, you know.
People who get themselves into trouble, it seems to be a running
theme. Well, and an unusual relationship. I love this unconventional relationship idea of, you know, ever since I saw Harold and Maude, you know, I've always loved the unconventional.
The older person and the younger person.
Yeah, people who aren't supposed to, on paper, they're not supposed to be friends. They're not supposed to fall in love, whatever it is. So I loved that idea. And I also just loved this messy, flawed, real female protagonist, that men get to do that all the time and women just not nearly so much, although a lot more lately.
Woman sort of anti-hero.
Yeah, the woman anti-hero who you're still empathetic with, hopefully, and are sticking with, but squirming a little bit as she makes some really interesting, sometimes just wrong-headed choices, you know, or lies, or does not necessarily likable things. And I think women have been so, you know, Hollywood has wanted to just hold them up as this paragon of, you know, the ideal. And so it's really nice to see real characters, you know, that actually are looking more like human beings.
Did you cast Keira Knightley or was she interested already?
Oh, no. I developed this movie for 2 years. So they worked on it. Alex Madigan, Anonymous Content, was the producer who developed it with Andrea Siegel, the writer. We cast it. We got the financing together. And I thought of Keira. I wanted to cast Keira. I was really thinking about the Bend It Like Beckham first Pirates movies,
yeah,
Keira.
Going back a few years.
Very contemporary, very, very easy in her skin and natural. And for somebody who's so gorgeous, she's just so not vain, you know, which I love in an actor. I'm willing to try for physical humor. And
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily have thought of her as comedic.
Well, I know. That's why I had to go back to the, because lately, I mean, you think of her, of
sometimes
all of these period pieces she's done.
Right.
And a lot of these pieces are just a little bit more stylized. They have to repress their feelings, you know, just because of the virtue of when they were set, the stories are set. But remembering the way she was in the beginning, I just always think of these like moments in that silly Pirates movie where she's just like so, you know,
Pirates
just scrappy,
of the Caribbean,
you know,
right.
Yeah.
Going
just,
back again a few years.
Exactly.
Well, so was it necessary to have a name like that in the lead as opposed to being able to finance it very small? And
yeah, it was several million dollars and we needed, you know, that's what the producers and investors felt like we absolutely needed to have. And there's the whole foreign number. A lot of it was foreign value, you know, to the star as well. Would be really helpful. So that was pretty key.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually got a different name in Britain. It's called Say mm-hmm. When? So how is it Say When there and Laggies here?
When I first got the script, I knew, I was like, oh, we're changing this name. And
it was called Laggies.
It was always called Laggies originally. And the story behind that name is that the writer thought that it was in common parlance. Like she really did, because she used it all the time with her high school friends. They would constantly just like, oh, come on, Laggies, we're late, whatever. So she was surprised that I'd never heard of this word. And I was like, oh, maybe I'm the only one. And we started asking around, and clearly she, you know, it became evident that she was the one who was a little crazy. So I thought, well, no one's going to know what this name is. It's going to be weird. And so we kept trying to come up with different names, alternate titles. And the problem was that all the alternates just felt so generic comparatively. So I came to really embrace it, realizing that, you know, as the decades roll on, we start seeing names recycled all the time. And I realized nobody's ever going to name their movie this. We're going to be the only laggies in the history of cinema, which I really liked a lot.
So why is it Say When in Britain?
Well, you know, what the guy from Icon said is that it tested really low and that everybody thought it was like a foreign word. And, you know, but Say When tested really high. It just worked for their audience.
So where do you come out on... You sort of are moving into the more commercial space with this. Mm-hmm. Do you want to keep going that way? Or are you going to just say, okay, now I'm circling back and doing something with three people?
I want to do everything. I actually have three things in development right now. One is probably three times the budget of this one. And it's sort of a different genre, like a comedy caper. I'm co-writing that with a friend. Another one is similar, very similar scale. And then a third one is like, again, like three or four people, improvisatory based, very small. So they all have their... draws to me, their attractions for various reasons.
Looking at the Guardians of the Galaxy sequel or something
like
that.
There you go. Why not? With something I've realized recently is with the right producer, if I could get somebody who, you know, the way that Lena Dunham is working with Judd Apatow, who really kind of creates this safe buffer zone for her. If I have somebody like that, I would work with a $200 million budget. Sure.
I have to ask you the inevitable women director question. Mm-hmm. I've read that you came to believe that you could do this when mm-hmm. you saw Claire Denis, who was older than you at the time. You were 37, mm-hmm. I think.
And yeah, I was 36, 37, I think. And she came to Seattle and had, at that point, probably five or six films or something that she had made. Her latest film at the time was Vendredi Soir, Friday Night, which had almost no dialogue at all in it. And at the time, I was like, okay, I really want to do this. It's all a secret conversation in my head. I wasn't talking to anybody else, but I was really nervous about writing a script, mostly because of dialogue. I wanted it to be really naturalistic. And I saw her new film, Vendredi Soir, and it was like, well, I could do that. I could make a movie like that because it conveyed so much purely cinematically. I mean, ironically, I ended up making all these movies that are just pure conversation.
Talking, yeah.
But you may note that a lot of it I didn't actually write. You know, a lot of the time I'm letting the actors do that part for me, and then I'm just like cutting it together, the best bits, just like a documentary filmmaker, you know. So I sort of found a way that worked for me. But yeah, and then I found out she was 40 when she made her first feature, and it was incredibly inspiring because not only was she 40, a late bloomer, but she was also a woman. And I was like, oh my God, it's not too late. I could still do this. And I remember thinking to myself, you have three more years to make your first
do something quickly.
To get going. Yeah.
So do you feel any encouragement? Because the numbers are grim when it comes to women directors.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I find encouraging is, I mean, I'm that I guess I'm making a living doing this, which
There's
is something
that.
I
That's
never,
a good,
ever
no?
thought I'd be mm-hmm. able to do. I thought I'm going to keep being an artist my whole life, but I'm always going to teach on the side, or I'm always going to have to do something on the side to make money. And the thing is, the way that it happened for me, yes, I did get that really lucky MacArthur-style break at the very beginning. But really, I've made my own way since then. I self-produced my second and third features and then asked my friend Stephen Chart to produce for me, you know, after that. And I didn't ask for permission to make my work. And so that's my key piece of advice for young women filmmakers, but also for any new filmmaker, is don't write a script that's going to cost $10 million and then go around begging for the money. Just write a script or find a script that's more doable, that's contained. Find your tribe of collaborators, grab a camera, and make work.
Lynn Shelton's new movie, Laggies, will be in theaters October 24th. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kim. It was a wonderful conversation.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.